by for a little while. As a result, they usually have the $50,000 or so worth of insurance that's part of their benefits package and feel that is more than enough. But since an unexpected tragedy affects people in all different ways, you never know for sure what might happen after you're gone. That's why this is a decision that must be discussed with the people who would be affected by such an event. All you need to know is that for every $500 a month of income you need about $100,000 of life insurance. When money is an issue, though, as it is for most of us, we don't always have the luxury of buying enough life insurance to assume the worst. With my clients, there's almost always a discrepancy between the maximum of insurance wanted and the minimum of insurance needed. Your needs, comfort level, and what you can afford all have to be taken into account. If you're using a professional to help you figure this out, make sure he or she has your needs and pocketbook in mind and isn't just thinking of all that the commissions will buy. In my opinion, there is only one kind of life insurance that makes sense for the vast majority of us, and that is term life insurance. When you sign up for term insurance, you're buying a just-in-case policy for a finite length of time that you need protection. These policies are not very expensive because the insurance company knows you have relatively little chance of dying while the policy is in force. Most likely, they won't have to pay a death benefit, and the premium is accordingly relatively small. With a whole life or universal policy, on the other hand, the insurance company knows it will almost certainly have to pay the face amount or the death benefit. You're expected to die with it, so they price it accordingly. It's true that whole life and universal policies have cash values, so if you decide not to keep it or if you suddenly need money while you're alive, one source would be the cash value of these policies. But commissions on life insurance policies are some of the most lucrative commissions in any business, and you're paying them. While you're considering life insurance for your loved ones, ask yourself another question. Do you know how fast nursing home costs would eat away at your assets? Listen to Anna and Art's story. When I first met them, Art insisted, "I'm only 53. I'm not going into any nursing home, and I'm not spending my money on any nursing home insurance." Art can't tell his story now. His speech is still too slurred from the stroke. This is what happened. When Anna and Art came into my office, I hardly noticed Anna. She was so tiny. Art, on the other hand, was huge, built like Smokey the Bear, with a great booming voice. Though soft-spoken, Anna, a schoolteacher, was not the least bit intimidated by her husband of 27 years. Art had been offered early retirement, and they had come to see me about whether he should take it. After going through all their finances, we decided that they should take the offer, which was an excellent package. Only one thing worried me. Anna had a heart condition, which had already been operated on twice. She was already scheduled for a third operation in 4 months. The good news was that, as a teacher, her health insurance coverage was excellent. But knowing of her condition and considering Art's age, I suggested that we look into long-term care or LTC insurance for Art. LTC insurance covers some of to all of the expenses the policyholder will incur if he or she were to enter a nursing home. As you will soon be able to tell, I love long-term care insurance. I believe that it's one of the most important policies you can have. Like most health or life insurance policies, LTC policies require that you qualify for them. And I knew that with her weak heart, Anna would never be eligible. But Art would. And such a policy, if he ever needed it, would provide protection for Anna that could make all the difference in the world to her. You see, what happens all too often with couples is that one of them ends up in a nursing home, and it takes every penny of income they both have just to pay for those nursing home bills. The person who is healthy and at home is left with no money to live on, and so has to start using the savings, retirement plans, the principal that they have spent a lifetime saving. Before you know it, all the savings is used up, and then, when the partner in the nursing home dies, the one who is alive and well is left penniless, perhaps with many years remaining to live. I see this happen all the time, and it's devastating, which is why I brought up the subject of LTC insurance with Art and Anna. The subject went over like a lead balloon. "Do I look like a man who is ever going to end up in a nursing home?" Art boomed, and I had to admit he had a point. I said, "Okay for now, but one day soon we are going to talk about this again." That day came just 5 months later. I received a call from Anna, who sounded very weak. She was slowly recovering from the heart surgery she had the month before, but her news this time was about Art. While she was still in the hospital, he had a massive stroke, leaving his right side paralyzed and slurring his speech. If either of them got worse, how would they manage? They both remembered that I had said that good nursing home care in that area in which they live today costs $3,500 a month, a huge amount, given their financial situation. Did I think there was any way Art would still qualify for LTC insurance? No, I didn't, not now. But Anna and Art got a very lucky break. The company that handled Anna's retirement plan was starting to offer group LTC insurance, and as part of their enrollment campaign, they were accepting all employees and spouses, regardless of their current health. I don't generally like group plans as much as individual insurance, but for Anna and Art, the plan offered them protection that most people in their situation couldn't get at all. Clients ask me all the time, "What if I never use long-term care insurance?" It will be wonderful if you never have to use it. The purpose of insurance is to cover catastrophes. You should hope you'll never have to use it. Now let me ask you a question. Do you have automobile insurance? If you have a car, you do. If so, have you ever used it? Only one out of every 240 people ever use their car insurance, but most of us still have it. How many people do you think use long-term care insurance? One out of every three among those who have it. This policy is used more than any other kind of insurance, yet it's the kind of insurance that way too few of us has. Why would you need long-term care insurance if you already have health insurance? Because there is not one health insurance policy in existence that covers long-term care. If the situation is this dire, and you're thinking it would be better all around just to dump the bills on Medicare, you couldn't, because Medicare won't pay them. Medicare will only pay 100% for the first 20 days of an LTC stay, and will only pay if the facility is a Medicare-approved skilled nursing home. Long-term care insurance is becoming the target of much interest today, and you'll be reading more about it, as more and more people are beginning to see why it's such an important quality of life issue, for the person who needs the care, but also for the loved ones left to try to pay for it. Beginning in 1997, corporations will be able to pay for LTC insurance coverage for employees and take the cost of the premiums as a business expense for the company. This employer-paid LTC will not be taxable to the employee. Individuals can now consider it as a medical expense, if it falls into the 7.5% adjusted gross income limitations. For the self-employed, LTC insurance is now a business expense. There has also been talk lately that LTC premiums will one day be completely tax deductible, or that we'll be able to buy it with the money already put away in our retirement accounts. Keep an eye out for more news about this topic. If this is the first time you've heard about it, it won't be the last. Long-term care premiums are based on how old you are when you purchase the policy. Let's say you are 54, in great health, and purchase a policy. I know of a great policy here in California, and other states are pretty comparable, for which you'd pay $954 each year for the premium. If you had waited until you were 65 to buy that policy, the premium would cost $2,580. Big difference. And the premiums are projected to stay stable for the whole time you carry the policy. These LTC policies can only raise the rates if there is an across-the-board increase for all those in the same state, region, or county who have this particular plan. Some people walk into my office wanting to buy an LTC policy, but we find, when we look at their financial big picture, that it isn't right for them because they can't really afford it over the long haul. This insurance is meant to keep you from going into the poorhouse in case of a long-term care stay, not to put you into the poorhouse just to pay for it. If you sign up at 54, you have to be able to afford it, both now and in the years after you retire. It will do you no good to buy a policy at 54, retire at 64, and find at 74 that you can no longer afford the premiums. You would have been better off not purchasing the insurance in the first place, but investing the money instead. What was the goal you wanted to accomplish by listening to this audiobook? Did you want to find a viable way to reduce your debt, put more money into retirement plans, figure out how to invest your money? Perhaps you're thinking, well, now I know all about wills and trusts, but that won't help me with my Visa bill, will it? Oh, but it will. What you need to know and believe is that when you have taken care of others, you have responded to the higher values of your existence. People first, then money. It's as if, on a material level, you're giving thanks by taking care of those who helped you enter the world, those to whom you gave life, those who have guided your passage through your life. By taking these actions, you remind yourself of who you really are and what is important to you in this life. This knowledge is a powerful force. I think it is almighty. The force starts to push forward like a bulldozer, clearing out all the obstacles that prevent you from living the life you deserve to live. Unlikely as it may sound to you now, you will be closer and closer to paying off your visa bills, taking that trip to Italy, or whatever your goals happen to be. Please take the actions outlined in this section. Do one this week. Make a call. Get quotes for insurance. Ask your parents about what would happen if they had to go into a nursing home. One action this week will clear you to take one action next week, and so on, until you have become responsible to those you love. Money is a living entity, and it responds to energy exactly the same way you do. It is drawn to those who welcome it, who respect the power it has, as well as the power it doesn't have. Wouldn't you rather be with people who respect you and who don't want you to be something you're not? Your money feels the same way. The second law of financial freedom is respect attracts money, disrespect repels it. This is one of the reasons why the rich get richer. If you're respectful of your money and do what needs to be done with it, you will become like a magnet, attracting more and more money to yourself. Now please write down all the ways in which you are both respectful and disrespectful to yourself and your money. Contemplate this for a while, and you'll begin to see how the actions you take in your life and with your money can erode your relationship with yourself and with your money. Some questions to consider. Do you spend more on your friends than you can afford to? Do you find yourself buying more presents for your children for the holidays or their birthdays than feels right to you? Have you ever bought a dress and decided when you got home that it really didn't suit you, but neglected to return it to the store in time to get your money back? Do you borrow things from friends and fail to return them? Do you sometimes forget to pay off personal loans from friends with the same regularity that you paid off a credit card? Do you constantly return videos a day late and have to pay the late fees even though you've already watched them? Do you often go out to dinner simply because you don't feel like cooking? At what cost over time? Do you sometimes pay your bills late when you didn't have to? After you have written down your answers, think back to occasions when your respect led to something great happening, or when your disrespect brought with it some unhappy consequences. It's very subtle, but the way we treat ourselves and our money touches upon every aspect of our lives. Step 5 of the 9 Steps to Financial Freedom is about being respectful of yourself and of your money, and taking actions to give that respect meaning. A couple of years ago, I was asked to counsel the employees of a company that was offering its 4th early retirement option to those employees age 50 or older. I discovered something very interesting. Even though most of the people I met had worked for this company for 25 years, and most of them were earning the same salaries the whole time, there was an even split of the people who came for counseling, with only a few exceptions. The vast majority either had around $400,000 in their 401k retirement plans, or else they had around $150,000. Big difference. What accounted for the difference? Were some simply better investors than the others? No. Nearly all these people had all their money in the company's stock. Even though they had other investment options, these were loyal employees. It wasn't that. Had some been in the company plan longer than others? It wasn't that either. Most of them had been in the plan for about the same time, give or take. One single factor accounted for the difference. Those who had $400,000 or more had contributed the maximum amount they were allowed to put into their 401k account from the beginning. Those who had $150,000 had simply put in 6% of their salaries, because that was all the company matched. Their attitude was, so why put in more than the company will match? One good reason for these people would have been $250,000. It is not respectful to yourself, to others, or to your money not to plan for your future. It is not respectful to yourself, to others, or to your money not to take full advantage of the 401ks or IRAs or the other retirement plans that are available to you. It is not respectful to yourself, to others, or to your money not to face your debt. To learn the basics of investing and to guard over your money, making sure that every penny you're spending is a penny that must be spent. The third law of financial freedom, part one, is the more you make, the more you spend. The third law of financial freedom, part two, is the less you think you make, the less you will spend. No, this does not mean to make less money. I hope you make as much money as you can. But there is a simple and remarkable effective way to make yourself spend less. You invest more. By putting more money into your retirement accounts, so your take-home check will be less. You will quickly train yourself to spend at a lower level, just as you used to do when you were making less money. You may say, as many of my clients have, "But Susie, I can barely afford to pay my bills as it is. How do you expect me to live today and still put money away for my retirement?" If you think you cannot make it today while you're working and have a paycheck coming in, how in the world do you think you're going to make it in the future when you still have essentially the same bills to pay but will have no paycheck coming in? The answer is that you won't. But if you start now, even on a modest salary, you can put aside an impressive amount of money. Not long ago, a couple came to my office, early 40s, nicely dressed, 2 children, annual salary of $35,000. The wife didn't work outside her home because the children were too small, although she planned to go back to work in a few years. They owned their own house and had 14 years left on their mortgage. They paid their credit card bills in full every month. They already had a sizable nest egg because the husband had been aggressively investing the maximum in his 401k plan at work. They had a few other investments that were doing nicely, earmarked to fund their children's education. I remember asking them, "How is it possible that you can do all this on just $35,000 a year?" He answered, "We only spend what we see. The company takes out the maximum for my 401k, and I also have them send money directly to our credit union. The credit union sends money directly to a mutual fund to invest it. Our take-home money isn't much, but at least we know we can spend it all and don't have to worry, so it works." I asked them why they had come to see me, and they said they wanted to make sure that they were covering all their financial bases. With immense respect for the job they were doing, I sent them home and told them not to change a thing. And here's another story. Maybe the predicament Judy found herself in will be familiar to you. A few years ago, my mom died and left me what I thought was a nice inheritance. At the time, I had just a few credit card bills, not more than, say, $2,000. But I sure loved having more money in the bank. My lover and I had been living together then for about 18 years, and we had always had a nice sharing relationship financially. But things seemed to change after I got that money. Before I knew it, I had spent more than half of it on things I had never really given much thought to before. And Deb, well, she started to spend more too. Before I knew it, our credit card bills were up to around $7,000. And that was before we bought our new apartment. But now I'm getting nervous about the future. I have a 401k plan at work, and I put in 6%, which is what the company matches. Deb doesn't even have a retirement plan at work. I probably should put more money away for retirement. I know it makes sense, but I really can't afford to, not with the mortgage and everything. Judy had it backwards. In fact, she couldn't afford not to put more money away for retirement. Having worked at the same corporation for 27 years, she had missed out on thousands upon thousands of dollars she could have saved painlessly, effortlessly, and tax-deferred. By receiving a little less in each paycheck, she would have earned herself far, far more in the long term for her retirement, which would be upon her not too many years down the road. The fourth law of financial freedom is, it's not what you make, it's what you get to keep. Money that goes into a retirement fund is money you do not have to pay taxes on until you take it out. Depending on your income tax bracket, you might be able to keep 28% more of your money right off the top. Because of the tax savings, contributing the maximum to your retirement account right now will not deprive you of as much current income as you might fear. And where it will make a vast difference is in what you'll have to spend later. Let's say that I convinced Judy to raise her 401k contribution to $500 a month or $6,000 a year. And let's say, too, that she's in the 28% tax bracket for federal taxes and 11% for state taxes. She will have saved $140 a month on her federal taxes and $55 a month on her state taxes. If she didn't put this money away, she would really only get to spend $305 a month after paying her taxes. Finally, I convinced her, and she promised to up her contribution to the maximum that week. She called me a few days later. The very day she raised her contribution, her boss had called her into her office to give her a mid-year raise. This was the first time in all these years she had been given a raise before the end of the year. She was stunned. I wasn't. This sort of occurrence, however you want to explain it, is not uncommon. I've seen it happen many times. If you are covered at work by a 401k, 403b, or simple plan, I want you to go into your human resources office and up your contribution to the maximum, if it isn't there already. If you have not signed up for your retirement plan, please do so now. If you are self-employed or your place of employment doesn't offer a 401k or similar plan, please keep listening and take the actions that are right for you. Once you've done this, write down the date you took the action and begin to keep track. See what happens in your financial life that never would have happened before. For Judy, it was a mid-year raise. Soon you will see that there is a direct correlation between taking a step towards financial freedom and watching your money take a step right back towards you. The plans known as 401k, 403b, and Simple allow you to contribute a percentage of your salary, usually around 15%, into the plan. A 401k, which takes its exciting name from a selection in the tax code, is an all-around plan that almost any company can enter into. A 403b plan is what you have if you work for a nonprofit organization, such as a hospital, university, or research organization. The 401k and 403b plans work in much the same way. If I refer to a 401k plan here, it will also apply to you if you have a 403b plan. As Simple is a new retirement plan that took effect January 1, 1997. The acronym stands for Savings Incentive Match Plan for Employees. This plan can be adopted by employers who employ 100 or fewer employees with at least $5,000 in compensation for the previous year and who do not maintain another employer-sponsored retirement plan. The contribution and withdrawal rules for Simples are just a little different, but the same basic concepts apply. The percentage and the amount you contribute will vary from employer to employer. Regardless of the percentage your company allows, the maximum dollar amount the government generally allows is $9,500 per year for 401k plans and $6,000 for Simples. But this number is tied to inflation and allows incremental increases of $500 as the need arises. The percentage that you decide to contribute, once okayed by the company, will be taken from your paycheck before taxes and deposited into the plan. The company administering the plan then invests your money for you. You will usually have a choice of several investment vehicles, which might include mutual funds, bond funds, or individual equities such as the stock of your own company. Typically, the choices will offer a range of risks and returns. Some investments are highly predictable, such as bonds, which produce steady income at minimum risk. The stock market is more variable, and the most aggressive growth funds may swing up and down considerably in value, while they offer a high return over time. Usually, you will be given extensive information about your investment options, and you can divide your contributions as you see fit among the different investments. The taxes on a retirement plan will be deferred until you take your money out, at which time it will be taxed as ordinary income. But if you withdraw funds from a retirement account before the age of 59 and a half, you will pay a 10% federal penalty on any amount withdrawn, as well as a state income tax penalty. You will also pay ordinary income tax on the money. With a Simple, it works the same way after the first 2 years. But if you take out the money within the first 2 years you participate in the plan, an early withdrawal tax of 25% will apply. However, there are exceptions. Very few people know this, but it's true. If you're 55 or older in the year of retirement from a particular company, you can withdraw whatever you like from what's known as a qualified employer retirement account without any penalty whatsoever. You will pay tax on this money as if it were ordinary income. The tax will be withheld from your withdrawal over the top in the form of a 20% withholding tax. You'll get a refund of this withholding tax if, when you file your return, you owe less than was withheld. If you owe more, you will have to pay the balance. This holds true only for employer-sponsored retirement plans such as the 401k. If you take your money out of your 401k and put it into, for example, an IRA rollover, this rule won't apply. When you leave your place of employment, many times you can leave your 401k right there and not have to take it out. Other times you might want to withdraw your money, and some companies may encourage you highly to take it out when you leave. Although if you have more than $3,500 in the plan, they can't force you to do so. In any case, there might come a time when you need a place to which you can transfer the money. You usually have two choices. If you're merely changing jobs, you can move it to the 401k plan at the new company, if the company has no time restrictions as to when you can enter its plan. If it does, until you qualify to join the plan, after you've been there a year at the latest by law, you can take advantage of the other option. That is to transfer the money from your current plan into an IRA rollover account. If you do this, you can continue to shelter all the money from taxes and invest it for your retirement. You can open an IRA rollover at a bank, mutual funds company, insurance company, or brokerage firm. If you're working for a company that still won't offer you a retirement plan, you can open an IRA or individual retirement account. Starting January 1, 1997, you can make an IRA contribution of up to $2,000 for yourself, and if you're married and your spouse is not working, you can also contribute $2,000 for them. What's the difference between a 401k and an IRA? Well, it's as much as $7,500 a year of possible income you can put away. The maximum you can put into an IRA for yourself is $2,000 a year. A big reason to push for a 401k where the max is $9,500. With a simple, you can possibly put away $4,000 more a year than you can with an IRA. Most people wait until they file their taxes in April to add to an IRA that they could have contributed to during the past year. A mistake that adds up. For the tax year 1997, for example, you have the right to put $2,000 in your IRA in January 1997. But most people wait until April 1998 to do so. This is an incredible waste of money. If you possibly can, I urge you to put that money away at the beginning of the year rather than at the tax deadline. If you invest your $2,000 in January and that money sits there earning 8%, by the time April 15th comes along, you would have $213 more in the account. If you kept this up, you'd have thousands of dollars more over the years you kept up this account. If you're self-employed and not incorporated, you also have excellent options for funding your retirement. You can open up what is known as a Simplified Employee Pension Plan, known as a SEP, a KEO, or a SIMPLE. All three of these are great ways to plan ahead. You can open a SEP and put away 13.0435% of your income, or $19,565, whichever is less per year, in payments for yourself. SEPs can be set up at banks, mutual fund companies, through index funds, brokerage firms, discount brokerage firms, almost anywhere you'd like to invest. If you have employees who have worked for you for 3 out of the past 5 years, you will have to put money in their SEPs as well, to the tune of the lesser of 15% or $22,500. It seems funny that you can put more money away for your employees than you can for yourself, but that's the law. A KEO plan, named after Senator Eugene KEO, who came up with the idea, can also be used to fund a retirement for the self-employed. KEOs are more complicated than SEPs, but do allow you, if your income warrants it, to set more money aside than you could with a SEP. With that privilege, though, comes an obligation. You must also fund a KEO for anyone who has worked for you for at least 1 year, and you must contribute the same percentage for those who work for you as you do for yourself. KEOs are divided into two types of plans. The first is known as a money purchase plan, and the second is known as a profit sharing plan. In a money purchase plan, you can put aside the lesser of 20% or $30,000 of your net earnings for the year. When you open up this account, you set the percentage up to 20% you would like to contribute of your net earnings from now on. The drawback of this plan is that whatever percentage you select, it's set in stone and cannot be changed. With a profit-sharing plan, you have more flexibility. Here, you can put away the lesser of 13.03% or $30,000. A simple plan lets you put up to $6,000 a year into a plan for yourself. If you have any employees who have worked for you and have made at least $5,000 in compensation over the past 2 years and are projected to do so again, they too are eligible for a simple. All contributions are considered vested the second they are made. This means that they belong to your employee even if he or she leaves your employ the very week after you've made the match. This is also true with 401k and other plans. Employed, self-employed, it doesn't matter. When it comes to money, time is probably the most important factor in the growth process. The more time you give to your money and the more time it has to grow are the two key ingredients to attracting and creating large sums. The amount you have accumulated when retirement comes will determine what kind of lifestyle you will be able to afford. If you're 45 and start putting $100 a month into an account that averages 10% return, you will have $71,000 by age 65. If you start 10 years earlier at 35, your $100 a month will have grown to $206,440 by age 65. But if you start saving $100 a month at age 25, you will have $555,453 by age 65. One thing your mind will try to tell you is that when you invest money, whether in your retirement account or on your own, you have to keep it safe and sound, that you can't afford to take risks with it. Wrong. The truth is that you really can't afford not to take risks. You have to invest this money for growth, especially if you are under the age of 50. The younger you are, the more aggressive you can be. As long as you have at least 10 years during which you don't have to touch this money, invest the majority of it for growth. Put it in whatever equity mutual funds your 401k offers. If you are in a simple IRA, SEP or KEO, and just want to keep your life as easy as possible, look into good no-load index and managed growth mutual funds. When you start approaching retirement and know that you will soon be living off this money, that's the time to consider easing up on your more aggressive investing. Even so, it's always best and perfectly safe and sound to have a nice mix of funds and keep your money diversified. When you begin paying yourself every month, as you do with a retirement plan, not only do you get more long-term bang for your buck, you also take the risk out of investing this money. When you put the exact same amount of money month in, month out, in the same investment vehicle, you are taking advantage of the investment strategy known as dollar-cost averaging. It puts time, your money, and the market all on your side at once. This is a lesson Michael learned the hard way. My company has a 401k, but I never joined it. I know that it would be a good way to build up retirement money, but I never knew which investments to put my money in. Plus, I was afraid to make the wrong choices. I'm more a cash kind of guy. But now I'm starting to make more, and I'm thinking of getting married to my girlfriend. I've been feeling more like a grown-up, I guess, and I was really thinking it was time to invest. Since it was the beginning of the year, I thought, why not start the year off right? And I signed up and started to contribute the maximum I could, which they told me was $750 a month based on what I made. I put all the money into this one aggressive growth mutual fund that seemed like it had done really well over the years. The first month, fine, and the second, but the market dropped and the fund tumbled way down. I couldn't believe it. By the time I had added my third payment, my $2,250 was only worth about $1,950. I had already lost money, but I decided to stick with it. 2 months later, after I put in another $750 for each of those months, I should have had $3,750, more if it was actually earning money. But when I looked at my statement, I only had $3,343. I was still losing money. This was when I couldn't take it anymore, so I went back to the Human Resources Department to withdraw from making any more contributions to the 401k. I mean, there's no point in losing money. I thought at least I could wait till the market started to go up and maybe then I would rejoin. Michael's trouble was that he understood only the concept that when you buy something, you want it to go up, better known as buy low, sell high. He didn't understand that what you want to do with dollar cost averaging, which is what you're doing with a 401k, is to buy low and lower and lower and then sell high. Michael had actually chosen a great fund to invest in. And since he had many years left until he retired, he should actually have been thrilled when they took a tumble. With dollar cost averaging, you are taking the money you're investing and averaging the cost of the shares you're buying over time. Since you are investing every month, wouldn't you rather buy into your funds when the market is low, so you don't have to pay so much for your shares? Of course you would. When what you are buying goes down rather than up, that means you're paying less and you're able to buy more. I always think of it as a mutual fund sale, getting what I want for less than others had to pay just a few months earlier. Michael got upset because the shares he bought went down in price over a few months. Had he stayed in for the long run, however, when his mutual fund started to climb again, he would have made it all back plus more. For example, Michael's January contribution of $750 bought 50 shares of stock at $15 a share. In July, when the stock had gone down to $12 a share, he could have bought 62.5 shares for that same $750 contribution. The first thing you need to know about investing is that there has never, in the history of the stock market, been a 10-year period of time during which stocks have not outperformed every single other investment out there, regardless of the day that you invested. Even if you had invested in a variety of stocks the day before the October 19, 1987 crash, when the market went down 500 points, and if you had left the money there, 10 years later you would have made far more money having done that than any other investment would have earned for you. The best investment advice I could give Michael was to go back into the 401k and put that $750 into it every month. But this time, diversify the money among two or three other good funds in the plan, be patient, and wait for time to touch his money. This kind of investing is being respectful to what you have and respectful to what you want to have. It is not going out on a financial limb or taking a gamble with everything you have. But you also have to watch over those things that whittle away at the money you want to create. You must also be respectful to the money you don't have. For many of us, debt is too big a part of our overall money picture not to give it the respect it is due. How we treat our debt and the people who are a part of that debt play a major role on our path to financial freedom. Credit cards can be as addictive and destructive as hard drugs, with the same ability to create a false sense of euphoria, giving you a quick fix by temporarily satisfying temporary desires. Drugs are different in one respect, though. In most cases, you have to seek out the drug dealer. Credit card companies seek you out. The more you use the cards, the more new cards with enticing offers and promises will come your way. If you can't pay off your credit card debts right now, today, then you're in credit card trouble, which can erode a solid financial foundation faster than anything. Debt feels like the heaviest burden of life. It weighs your spirits down, keeps your mind occupied with your burden, and makes you feel bound because you are bound. There are two kinds of debt, personal and institutional. Personal debt is money you owe to a family member, friend, or any other human being who has loaned you money. Institutional debt is money you owe to a credit card company, a business, a school, the IRS, a bank, a credit card company, and so on. When people come to see me and start facing the truth about their finances, they'll often say, "Well, I owe my brother $5,000, but what I'm really worried about is that I owe $8,000 on my credit card bills." But I've seen money destroy personal relationships so many times, and I know what loaning money to or borrowing money from someone you care about can do to both of you. Remember, people first, then money. Personal debt is every bit as important as institutional debt. Even if you have permission from the person who loaned you money to take your time, it will still weigh heavily on your heart every time you think about it, which will be often, and fail to take action. Not paying debts will not make them go away, but it will make your money vanish, and possibly your friendships too. Another scenario that plays itself out often in my office is when one spouse or partner has to admit to the other that he or she is hiding debt, usually credit card debt, from the other. More than once I've heard, "Oh, so that's the secret. I thought maybe you were having an affair." Responses to the news vary. Some couples decide to deal with it together. Some feel that the person who created the debt has to deal with it. Whatever the response, the outcome after the blow-up, if there is one, is always a relationship that's truer and more honest. Please tell your partner if you're hiding debt. Your integrity and self-respect are more important than money you owe to some vast institution. First thing, all credit cards must be cut up. If you are not willing to do this right now, it's a sign that you need some serious help. It means that you still don't understand the implications of having debt of this kind, and that you are still being disrespectful to yourself and to your money. People are often afraid not to carry credit cards, and if you feel this way, carry one for emergencies by all means. But lower the credit available to you by calling the company and asking them to lower it. A simple phone call. Pick the amount of credit you would like to have in case of an emergency, maybe $500 or $1,000, for example, and ask them to set it there. Or carry an American Express card, the one on which you have to pay the entire balance every month, or they'll be all over you like a cheap suit. You wouldn't stock the kitchen with cookies if you were dieting, would you? Why keep credit around that you don't need and you don't want to use, if the temptation might get you into trouble? Then it's time to sit down with your debt. Study your statements, face what you owe, and see what they're charging you to owe it. Make a list of all the monies you owe in descending order, starting with the highest interest charges first. List the phone number of everyone you owe money to. Please include personal debt. List the amount you owe, the interest rate, the minimum monthly payment, and how they charge you this interest payment. If you're late with any of these payments, personal or institutional, call them up now and tell them why. All the entities to whom you owe money already know that you don't have the money to pay the bill, or you would have, so don't be embarrassed. If you're not late with your payments, call up the high-interest credit card companies anyway. Tell them you're considering switching to a better value card, and see if they'll match a lower rate. You can negotiate with them, and often they will reduce your interest rate right on the spot. If you're in big credit card trouble, don't panic, but you can get out of it, step or a month at a time. I have found that most people are not aware of how very important it is to pay more than the minimum. Let's say you owe an average balance of $1,100 on a card that charges 18.5% interest. If you pay the minimum every month of 1.7% and you never charge another thing, it will take you 12 years and 6 months to pay off your debt. It will have cost you $2,480.94 in interest. Same situation, but if instead you had paid $10 more than the minimum each month, you would have cut the payment period down to 6 years and cut the total interest payment to $676.37. That is a savings in interest of $1,805.57. Here are the steps that many people, including a number of my clients, have taken to get out of debt. You can do it too. 1. Figure out the absolute largest amount you can afford to pay monthly towards your credit cards. Let's say that amount is $600. 2. Review the list of creditors you made up and total the cost of the minimum monthly payments, plus $10 for each of them. If the minimum payment on one card is $150, write down $160 and so on. Now total those figures. 3. Subtract this total from the number you wrote down in step 1. Let's say the total minimum payment plus $10 for all your credit cards is $400. You've decided that, in fact, you can pay $600 a month towards eradicating the debt. Subtract the $400 you must pay from the $600 you can pay, and this leaves you with $200 extra to pay on your credit cards. 4. Now take the extra $200 and put it each month towards the credit card that is charging you the highest interest rate. When that card is paid off, call the company and close the account for good. 5. Now you start all over. Stick with $600 a month, unless you can raise it, as your debt paying allocation. Total all the minimum payments of your remaining cards, adding on $10 to each card. Let's say that this figure is now $300 a month. Subtracting this from the $600 you have allocated a month, leaving $300. Pay that $300 to the card that is now charging you the highest interest rate. When this card is paid off, call the company up and cancel it and start all over again with the third card. But if you're really in credit card trouble, you have another option. You may be able to borrow from yourself through your 401k plan at work. Many employers will let you borrow up to 50% of the money you have in your plan up to $50,000 to buy a house, pay off bills, or for other situations that qualify. The prospective downside is that if you happen to leave the job or get fired, the money you borrowed is due in one lump sum. If you are thinking of taking a loan out and there is a possibility you may leave your current employer, you might want to give this possibility some consideration. Another alternative, if you're really in credit card trouble, is to take out a home equity loan to pay off your debt. A home equity loan has its advantages. The loan will almost certainly be at a lower interest rate than your credit card, and often that interest is tax deductible. So you will have converted a high interest non-tax deductible debt to one that has lower interest and is tax deductible. The amount of money that you can take out of your home with this kind of loan is based on a percentage of the equity that you have in your home. Equity is the difference between what your house is worth and how much you owe on your mortgage. In other words, if your house is worth $200,000 and you have a mortgage of $150,000, it means that you have about $50,000 equity in your home. Can you then take out a $50,000 home equity loan? No. Most banks will only let you borrow a total of 80% of the value of your house, including all current mortgages. If your house is worth $200,000, 80% of its value is $160,000. Subtract the $150,000 you owe on the first mortgage, and this gives you the amount you can get a home equity loan for if you qualify. In this case, $10,000. Once out of debt, you'll find the pleasure of not creating debt far exceeds the momentary distraction of buying something on credit that you really don't need, can't afford, and won't really care about much beyond the time you get it home. What is more, all the money you've been pouring into interest charges can now go instead towards creating wealth, investing in yourself and your future. If you saw a quarter on the street, would you stoop to pick it up? Of course you would. We all would. Would you throw a dollar on the street for someone else to pick up? I doubt it. Yet without knowing it, you may be throwing away hundreds or thousands of dollars in found money for you and your future just by the way you're dealing with your financial life. Most people try to set up their lives for convenience, to make things easy. But easy can be costly. Respecting yourself and your money means wanting to put every penny you can to work for you. Respect attracts money, remember? You might have found money right now, a few hundred dollars a year here, a few hundred there, or more. Wouldn't you like to find it? You can if you are just willing to look. If you're willing to rearrange the pieces of your financial life just a little, you'll be able to see the solution to the puzzle and find the money. One essential thing you need to do is make sure you and your money are keeping good company. If there is a company, bank, brokerage firm, credit union, mutual funds company, or anywhere else that's offering you a higher interest rate or lower fees than where you are currently keeping your checking or savings account, it is your duty to yourself to transfer your money into a higher paying account. You put time and energy into finding the lowest rates for your credit cards, right? That same kind of energy needs to go into finding the highest rates for your cash. So wherever your money is now, ask yourself the following questions, and if you don't know the answers, find out. How much is the money in your checking and savings accounts earning? How much should they charge you for your checks or as a service fee? Now you need to find out whether you can get a higher interest rate somewhere else, whether you can be charged less in fees, and whether you can establish an account that is just as safe and just as convenient. The answer is probably yes. A money market account can be had through a bank, a full-service brokerage firm, a discount brokerage firm, mutual funds company, or through a credit union. It works like a bank account. You keep your money there and write checks against it. There are various rules sometimes, but you can always find a money market account to suit you. When you put your money into a money market account, you are buying shares in the fund. The share price does not fluctuate in value the way it does with stocks or mutual funds. Money market shares are priced at $1 a share and do not fluctuate. How is a money market account different from a bank account? In the interest it pays, which can add up to more, sometimes far, far more, than you'd get from almost any checking or savings account, as well as the ways in which the money is protected. One of the main reasons many of my clients got nervous about opening a money market account is that the funds aren't covered by the FDIC, which means they're not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Even so, funds in a money market fund are extremely safe. Essentially, every money market fund has a manager who oversees the money that people like you and me deposit into the fund and lends it out to different entities. The federal government, state governments, various large institutions or corporations. These are all very short-term loans, usually for about 30 days, and they have a nice interest rate attached to them. If you still feel uneasy with the idea of money market accounts, you might consider investing in those accounts that invest in U.S. Treasuries. Treasuries are guaranteed and backed by the taxing authority of the government, which means that if the government can't pay the money back when it is due, they will be forced to raise taxes to do so. When I was training to be a broker, and this still holds, the only time I was allowed to use the word guaranteed was when I was talking about a U.S. Treasury bill, note, or bond. In short, even though these kinds of money market accounts are not insured by the FDIC, they are backed by the taxing authority of the U.S. government, which in my opinion is certainly as safe as, if not safer than, FDIC insurance. My favorite place to establish a money market account is at a discount brokerage firm, but many discount firms don't like it if you write more than 15 checks a month. Some, on the other hand, could not care less. If you write more than 15 checks each month, you may find that it's just as cost-effective to keep your checking account where it is and to move only your savings account to a money market account. There may be other rules governing the account. Minimum balance, minimum you can write checks for. So keep your needs in mind and ask questions before you set up the account. Almost every brokerage firm, including discount brokerage firms like Charles Schwab, offer a money market account. The one at Schwab is called the Schwab One account. Usually the difference between an account at a full-service firm like Merrill Lynch and a discount firm like Schwab is the minimum needed to set up the account and the amount of the yearly fee they charge to keep the account. At Schwab, you can set up a money market account for $5,000. If you keep $5,000 in the account at all times, it's free. Otherwise, they'll charge you $5 a month or $60 a year, unless you make 2 commission trades in the year, in which case there's no fee. This is better than the CMA account at Merrill, which has an entry fee of $20,000 and charges $100 a year. So moving your money to a place where it will earn the best possible interest is one way of picking up quarters on the sidewalk. Here are the other ways to pick up found money. Paying taxes quarterly rather than monthly. If you are self-employed or retired and getting a pension check, did you know you don't have to have taxes taken out of your checks each and every month? The interest that this tax money could earn could be about $100 or $200 a year, which, invested yearly over 40 years at 8%, well, could be between $25,000 and $50,000. If you can, pay your taxes by using an estimated tax payment schedule, which means that 4 times a year you need to send in an installment payment of the taxes that you will owe. Here, too, you have a choice. In these 4 installments, you need to send either 100% of what last year's tax liability was or 90% of what this year's is projected to be. If your adjusted gross income last year was more than $150,000, the IRS will make you pay 110% of last year's tax liability or 90% of what this year's will be. States all have their own rules for estimated taxes, so it would be wise to check. You would naturally choose to send in whichever was less. Let's say last year you owed $8,000 in taxes, but this year you took a large sum of money from your retirement plan, and as a result, you will owe about $18,000 in taxes. Your choice is to send in 100% of last year's taxes, 4 installments at $2,000 each, or you can pay 90% of what you expect this year's tax liability to be. In this case, 90% of $18,000 equals $16,200. By making installment payments, you could keep the remaining $8,200 you owe in a money market fund or interest-bearing account of some kind. Instead of letting the IRS earn interest on your money, you're earning it, and it can add up to a nice sum. Another option is to pay off your 30-year mortgage in 15 years. Let's say that you buy a house with a 30-year mortgage of $150,000 at 8%. You will be scheduled to make 360 payments of $1,093, paying a total of $393,606 by the time your house is paid for. That interest can sure add up to the tune of about $243,000 over time. However, if you pay off this 30-year mortgage in 15 years, you will pay far less in interest. Your payments would be higher, $1,424 a month, rather than $1,093. But since you would be paying them for only half the time, you would have shelled out a total of $256,316 to own your house free and clear, or $137,290 less than if you did it over a 30-year period of time. That's quite a savings. There are several other options available to you as well. Sending in one extra mortgage payment per year, for example, and specifying that it be used against the principal will start to reduce a 30-year mortgage. Asking your bank to withdraw half of your payment of $1,093 every 2 weeks from your account, rather than sending in the entire amount monthly, will pay off the 30-year mortgage sooner as well. Also, don't apply for a 30-year mortgage when you intend to pay it off in 15 years. Did you know the interest on a 30-year mortgage is usually higher than the interest on a 15-year mortgage? The 8% you're paying in the example before for your 30-year mortgage would most likely have been only 7.75%, or a 0.25% less if you had applied for a 15-year mortgage to begin with. You need to give thought to this before you apply for your mortgage. If you are planning to pay it off in 15 years, why would you apply for a 30-year mortgage in the first place, the way so many people do? For a safety net, right? You figure, well, if the money gets tight, you can always go back to paying it off with less expensive monthly payments over a longer period of time. Your safety net, based on the difference between 7.75% and 8%, is costing you $21 a month, which, if you invested that difference at 8%, adds up to $7,093 over the course of the 15 years. Another way of looking at it is that you've just left 28,372 quarters on the street. Don't have the mortgage company withhold your property taxes and insurance payments rather than paying them yourself when they come due. Wasn't it nice when you signed up for your mortgage and the lender said, "Why don't we just go ahead and add your property taxes and the insurance to the bill every month, and we'll pay it all for you?" Sure, it was nice for them. Property taxes and insurance both come due twice a year. But by saving yourself the hassle of writing four simple checks a year, you're paying them every single month and losing out on the interest the money could be earning. It is not far-fetched to think you could have earned $240 a year on the